So let me go to our remote newspaper panel with us this morning, all in different corners of the country, all joining us through different means of teleconferencing. I'm delighted to say we have with us this morning Sinead O'Carroll, who is the editor of the Journal.ie, Fergus Finlay, who's the former chief executive of Bernarders, and he's now a member of the board of the HSE, and Mick Clifford, who is special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Good morning to all of you, and thanks very much for agreeing to do this. I know this is not quite the usual newspaper format that we all know, so it's going to be a learning experience for all of us. But firstly, just before we get into the topic of the newspapers, I wanted just to see how you all were. And Sinead, you in particular, you find yourself in isolation this weekend.
I am, and I do have my own little studio set up here, Gav. I'm in underneath a blanket and between all soft furnishings, so hopefully the connection is okay for everybody. Yeah, myself and my husband are in self-isolation. We're, I think, 10 days in. I think we're allowed out in 4 days' time. We both started getting sick about 10 days ago. So we're unsure if it is COVID-19. I had a test done a week ago because of some medical history around pneumonia and asthma. So I'm still waiting to see if it is COVID-19, but it's not a pleasant dose, whatever it was.
No, you've been waiting for a week for your results. That must be quite agonising as well, particularly if you have that bad history of asthma and pneumonia yourself.
I think probably because I'm tuning into Dr. Tony Holohan every night, and he's explaining, you know, journalists are asking the same questions every night about waiting for tests, and I'm just trying to be pragmatic about it. And one of the things that I'm thinking is, even if it's positive or negative, the best thing I could do for society in general is to stay inside, because we did, even if it wasn't COVID-19, we have some sort of a dose. Mm. And the last thing people out there need is something else going around. So I'm not too bothered that we don't have a negative or a positive. We just need to stay inside for the 2 weeks anyway. I am looking forward to my being allowed out for the 2 kilometer exercise in come Wednesday or Thursday, because we are feeling much better now.
Yeah. On a practical note, I'm looking forward to how has it been for your working life? Because obviously you've still had to try and perform duties as editor of the Journal.ie as well. And when none of you or very few of you are actually in the office, how challenging has that made it, trying to keep the show on the road at a time when people, of course, are consuming more media than ever?
Yeah, we've been busier than ever, and obviously there's just so much to report on and so many questions that our readers need answered, and we also have a fact-checking initiative just to try and dispel some of those terrible rumours and hoaxes that are going around social media and WhatsApp. And the team has been phenomenal. I think this is one of the things that Ireland has seen in general, just the resilience of people being able to change their lives very quickly and easily. I think journalists are used to, and Gav, you know this from, you know, running around and being able to file copy from anywhere or file broadcasts from anywhere. Mm. So it's just doing that on a much larger scale. And the technology that's available to us, like being able to do a studio panel from our sitting rooms, we're able to, you know, make sure that we have FaceTimes with each other and that we have meetings, and that we're connected to our readers in a way as well. So we're connected to our readers in a way that's different to usual as well. We send an email every day to readers who are interested in kind of getting all the up-to-date coronavirus information, and they're emailing us back at a huge rate. So it's become much more personal. The news, which is lovely, and as an editor it's really nice to see, and as you said, yeah, busier than ever, just way more readers than usual, more content than usual, and just trying to keep everybody well. We've been really lucky that most of our team have stayed well and are able to remain active as essential service workers, so, you know, going out to those press conferences and getting the answers that we need.
One thing that I do find remarkable, and this is just as a personal side note to it, that everyone obviously has been focusing on how everyone has had to work remote, and that we now all have all these teleconferences or Zooms or whatever just to try and keep in touch professionally. But you nearly forget how much of a personal rapport you have with the people that you walk around on the same bit of carpet with ordinarily for the same 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day as well. So that it's not just about the professional collaboration when you're having a meeting over Zoom. It's actually just about checking in with these people, because otherwise they're such a prevalent part of your lives. And it's great that people are able to still do that too. Let me go to Mick Clifford. Mick, you're ordinarily Dublin-based, but you managed to bolt down to West Cork. I presume that was before the shutdown, or else you are very guilty of unnecessary travel, my friend.
No, I don't know where you heard the West Cork, Gavin. No, I actually went down. My mother is living in Cork City. She's living alone. She has no other family down there. So, you know, basically to check in every so often, one of us goes down, to see what's needed. And that was something of a surreal journey, I have to say, in terms of the motorway, in terms of the lack of people, in terms of going down to the family home and not being able to go inside, quite obviously, and shouldn't go inside. And luckily it was a dry day, so I got a chair and sat out the back, and my mother sat inside the back door, and we had a conversation for a couple of hours. But that was definitely very surreal. I mean, in terms of my own lifestyle, I'm, unlike a lot of people, Gav, I work from home, so that adjustment is not major for me. However, the thing about working from home is you get out frequently, go to the Dáil, the courts, meet people, all that, of course, is gone. The other big adjustment for me is that normally it's me, the dog and the cat in our domain here at home during the day, and now currently we are unfortunately crowded out. One other thing just to mention, this is, sorry, a bit of a sour note in terms of something. We all know now how Zoom is being used. One of the initiatives that came up, a local football club my young fella plays for, and I gave a handout, and one of the trainers there started putting together a system whereby we do this remote training for the kids. And they agreed yesterday that somebody in a club just up the road from here had hacked into one of these Zoom setups with child pornography. And I mean, really, at this point in time, when you're trying to keep kids focused and engaged and the whole thing, that level of stuff is just worth bearing thinking about, you know?
Yeah, what's really unfortunate about that is that it seems to have hit multiple clubs. That I think Ballymun Kickhams was named as one of them. It was having a nursery session. But I think what's happening there is that if you join a Zoom room but you don't have it password protected, if it's just a case that you can enter in the digits for whatever meeting room it is, then there are some people who are just brute force putting in any number of digits. They don't care whether it's an active meeting room or who the audience is, and they just go in there and they drop some really pornography there, which is absolutely not appropriate for younger eyes at all. I don't think they're particularly targeting younger groups, but it is an issue with the amount of video conferencing that there is, that some people can just drop in and leave all sorts of content there. So it is obviously very worrisome for a lot of people, and I think the GAA has discouraged its use on a national basis now as a result. Not to talk too much about those who are sort of near and dear to you, but you mentioned going down to check on your mother. How is she finding the whole idea of cocooning and not being able to even have physical contact with you or your other siblings?
Well, she finds it very restrictive, obviously, but I mean, she's very fortunate in that she's in very good health. I think what she really misses, to be honest with you, is her exercise in terms of walking. In terms of walking every day, that kind of exercise, used to do a bit of swimming, but she's been very adaptive and very fortunately lives in a detached house. So she literally walks around the house dozens of times in the day in order to get her exercise, which I think is fantastic. Other people, and I think she's very aware how lucky she is, other people who may not be in such good health, who are cocooning, don't have it that easy. But look, like everybody, it's restrictive, but God knows there are so many people in far worse circumstances at the moment. There's no question about that, you know?
Yeah, well, it's good that at least that you guys are able to at least even sit outside the patio door and at least sort of have a virtual cup of tea with her that way. We're still working on trying to get Fergus back. We might end up just using a regular old phone line with him, but we'll plough on with just the two of yourselves for the time being. Sinead, there's a few startling stories on the front pages of some of the papers. Where do you want to start, or what strikes you as the most remarkable piece in today's papers?
Well, I think probably the one that we've been trying to get to the bottom of for most of the week, and Susan Mitchell has an exclusive of the HSE audit of the PPE equipment that has come from China, and has just found out a bit more. We knew that a lot of the consignment wasn't fit for purpose following reports during the week from healthcare workers, you know, of gowns that were too short in the arm, or masks that, you know, we didn't know which way around they should be worn. And Susan has seen the HSE audit, and that a lot of equipment, or more than the HSE had led us to believe during the week, is not suitable for healthcare environments. And I think while I think most people understand the pressures and the global demand and the global pressures on the supply chain for this kind of equipment, I think it is good to know the extent of the problem. And it's good for healthcare workers to know the extent of the problem as well, instead of being told, look, we have adequate supplies and we're trying our best. We are spending over 200 million euro on PPE, So we need to know that what's coming is usable for healthcare workers. I guess Paul Reid said during the week that it's not what healthcare workers will be used to, but that's very different to not being fit for purpose at all in a healthcare setting. I think part of it is not to have a blame game, it's just to get the information.
Yeah, no, that's what struck me mostly about this, because I think it was Wednesday or possibly Thursday night that Paul Reid did that video where he just sort of appeared to sort of play it down to the extent by saying that it wasn't what people were used to. But now we see this audit, which was actually conducted on Monday, so it was before a lot of this stuff would have been distributed. And even I noticed in the last couple of minutes, Susan Mitchell has started tweeting more slides from that audit so that the world can see exactly what's there. And for example, one of the medical surgical masks with the elastic loops around the ears, the HSE audit notes that it's not even clear which side is supposed to be the inside and which is the outside, and that there could be loads of different sizes. It's not clear from the packaging which size is which. There's no specific specifications there that you can evaluate compliance with, and that they're basically saying that it's not for healthcare worker use, which is far from ideal. Mick, your thoughts on that report from Susan Mitchell this morning?
Yeah, I suppose some of it comes down to communication, Gavin. I mean, look, we're used to normal circumstances. Anybody in terms of the communication business puts the best foot forward, and that's the nature of things, and that's understandable. But because of what people are being asked to do and because of what they are doing, I think there's less patience with anything that might be perceived in any way as spin. For example, Paul Reid, who I think I have to say is doing a very good job overall, unquestionably, and somebody who's come in a baptism of fire. But I mean, he did seem to downplay the extent of problems with this consignment during the week. And yet Susan Mitchell tells us that in 4 out of 10 of the items that were audited, they were deemed not suitable for healthcare environment. Now, that's a bit more than a bit of a problem with some of them, you know. Mm. So it's just, I think the requirement at the moment to be level with the people in every way possible, while obviously being cognizant of you don't want to spread panic or anything like that, it is a delicate balance, but it's one, I think, that they just want to take a bit more care with. Same goes for testing. We've had issues around testing in terms of promises about how much testing there was going to be. We'd stuff early on in terms of there was no cognizance given to the issue around capacity of testing when testing was very widespread. There's a couple of things there that obviously, do you know what I mean? Look, and the other thing, coming back to it, Mike Ryan has said, you know, speed is the thing in instances like this rather than perfection, but at this, and mistakes are going to be made, but how you recover from those mistakes, I think, is a very important thing.
Absolutely. Guys, we're going to go, Sinead, you want to come in there, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, because if you look at that the other way, Mick, and you communicate it properly, in when you're looking for something like what was said, you're looking for speed, not perfection. So 6 out of 10 of the items are usable. So like if you just look at it that way, look, we're doing our best. We're trying to get things as quickly as possible. If you're more upfront with those numbers, if we had known that on Thursday, I think that's a better message than being told 4 days later that 4 out of 10 of the items aren't workable. And I think it's the same with testing. And we had a situation where Colin Thomas, our reporter, during the week, you know, asked for the figures. We knew the testing figures from Monday, and was asking for the figures later on in the week. He was told that they knew the figure and it was significantly higher, but wouldn't tell us what the actual figure was. So if we're being told it's significantly higher and people know, just it's better just to tell us the actual number, and then we can figure out ourselves where we're going. You know, the numbers, we're still comparatively doing well on testing, but because of the lack of information and that vacuum, it feels like we're not being told. And it just, as Justine McCarthy said today in her column, there's just a chink in the trust now.
Yeah, I think the transparency of that is an issue. Mick, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah, no, I absolutely think Sinead's spot on. And I mean, just emphasising again that, you know, as I say, communication, the nature of it is the best foot forward, which some of us can interpret at times as spin. But it's in the context of what the people are being asked to do, both in terms of social distancing, self-isolating, and being aware that with every passing day, a huge chunk of the population are getting more stressed out about the prospect of what their economic circumstances are going to be like when we come out of this. Now, in that kind of an environment, the level of trust that is required by the general population is higher than would normally be the situation. So I think we just need to be aware of that.
We'll see if we can get some more guidance on exactly how many tests are being conducted or what exactly the situation is. We have Colm Henry with us after 12 o'clock, so we'll put those questions. I think one other issue, by the by, I tweeted this morning that the latest figures from the HPSC, which is the body that actually compiles the number of COVID transmissions and cases and admissions to hospital, it says 158 people had been admitted to intensive care units as of midnight on Friday night. But of course, it is only very sporadically that we're able to get any details on how many of those people may have passed away, how many of them have been discharged, so exactly what the current population of ICU is. And of course, on a nationwide basis, we still don't have any overall number for the figure of recoveries, which of course would help a lot of people feel a little bit more upbeat. Mick, do you believe that the week that we've just had might have been a slight change of tone from the media, where previously there was a sense, not of compliance, but I think maybe the media recognised that part of its job was to try and get information out there. But it seems as if we've crossed the line now where the media has gone back to its primary role being scrutinising, and that it's not maybe terribly happy with what it's hearing from the organs of state.
Yes, I think that's fair enough, Gavin, definitely. And I mean, I think that is because of what has come out in terms of inconsistencies around testing, particularly in relation, I think it might have been soon after Patrick's Day, Simon Harris suggested we'd be up to 15,000 a day. Then there was talk of 10,000, then 5, and it turned out it was 2,000 to 3,000 a day, and that was literally the taking of swabs. About half of that were producing results daily. So there was definitely an issue around that, and I think perhaps that set off some alarm bells in the media in terms of this requires closer scrutiny. And look, it is being done in the context that this is completely new to everybody and it is inevitable that mistakes will be made. However, there's a difference between mistakes being made and a certain spin being put on things for whatever reason. And some of those reasons may make sense. But as I say, in the environment at the moment, it is vital that people are being levelled with, and I think there are issues around that, particularly to do with testing. One other thing in relation to testing too, Gavin, I just wonder, and testing is going to become vital after the peak, and when we're trying to get back to some form of normality afterwards, I think testing is really going to be vital, both the testing for the virus and the antibody test to show whether or not you've had the virus. But in relation to that, I think, you know, have we totally exploited the capabilities in this country of laboratories in terms of developing tests and producing enough volumes of testing equipment and that? I would just question that.
Yep, it's a very fair question. It's one we tried to put to Colm Henry as well. Let's move on to some of the other issues that's raised in the papers today. Sinead, I know that you were also very much taken by that piece. I mentioned the photograph of it on the front page of the Sunday Independent and the excellent piece on page 4 inside, I think it's page 4, that Alan O'Keefe has written about a funeral in the Liberties. And it's really, it's very, very striking stuff about the new normal, as it were.
Yeah, because I think the idea of how funerals have changed, and funerals are obviously such an important part of Irish life and how we cope with death. And it's just the most stark example of how our lives have changed so utterly. And it's Alan English's first edition of the Sunday Independent as the new editor. And, you know, we talk about it being thrown into the deep ends of editorship to take over at a time like this where your entire team is working remotely and has, you know, done a fantastic job. I think that striking image on the front page and the corresponding piece, just looking at how this man was such a stalwart of the Liberties area, John Gallagher, and nobody could come to the funeral. People were tuned in on video link. There was music, there was a eulogy, but there was no human connection. There was no hugs, there was no handshakes. And just even thinking of that, and the amount of people around the country now, this person, John Gallagher, did die of COVID-19, but there's so many people who didn't around the country whose families are trying to mourn them in such a way that is just completely alien to us. And I think technology does help. I know I have an Instagram friend who lost her dad during the week, and, you know, she says the messages coming in from people are so helpful, but just not being able to hug your friends or your family when that happens. And Anna O'Keefe really captures that in this piece of, you know, a hearse but no cars coming after it, this complete silence, where usually there is silence, but it's it's surrounded with love and knowledge of the person, and that this is, it's just such a stark reality. And I think it's captured so well in that report and in the photographs as well, of this new reality for people who are in grief.
Yeah, that article is on page 10 of the Sunday Independent. He's also coined in the course of this, Alan O'Keefe, a wonderful new phrase. He remarks that streaming services in the past were mainly for members of the Irish diaspora in foreign countries, but since the virus crisis began, streaming was mainly for the new diaspora, people who lived nearby but couldn't physically be there in person. Fergus Finlay, we've got you on the phone because technology was acting the maggot with us, but it is it's striking just how many people are affected by this in terms of the way in which funerals now have to be conducted, and how it's only really when you can't do it that you appreciate just how important the Irish funeral is in terms of how this country grieves with its losses.
There's no doubt about that, Gavin. And if I may, just for a second, first of all, apologies for all the technological problems. Probably my fault because of my advanced age and decrepitude, but hey, who knows? I did want to just say about that funeral story by Alan English this morning, what a moving story it was. All the more so because I knew John Gallagher very well. We worked on a committee together for a number of years. And if that had been a public funeral, the entire population of the Liberties would have been there, and the entire population of Dublin 8, because he was an incredibly loved man. He was a wise, self-effacing, modest, humble councillor for the area, who never, ever, ever let anybody down. He'd be terribly, terribly missed. And I'd say an awful lot of people, including myself, were really, really sorry not to be able to go to his funeral and pay our last respects. It's a very sad story.
His death notice did say that John's family look forward to welcoming everybody to the celebration of his life, which will rival the funeral of Daniel O'Connell. When it does happen.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. He was one of those men that you wouldn't know he was in the room until maybe there was a row going on, and then John would speak, and the whole room would fall silent because they knew they were about to be told something that was both wise and useful and productive. He carried weight, you know, because he only spoke when he needed to speak, and because he was trusted. He was a great fella. I've done a lot of funerals in my time, particularly in recent years, and the whole business of not being able to pay your respects is so anti-Irish in some ways. You know, we're just deeply uncomfortable with it, it seems so alien to us. Somebody once said that the one thing we do really well in Ireland is death and mourning and funerals, and that inability to not to be there is very painful, really painful.
It is a really remarkable
piece.
We turn
up for each other, I think.
Sorry, Sinead, go ahead.
Yeah, we turn up for each other, and I think that there are the times I think you see people at funerals who you might not have seen for years, but you expect to see them when you think, oh yeah, that makes sense that they are here in this room right now. I think people can still do it, but it's just in a vastly different way that it does make you choke up. Even like, I don't know, I never knew Mr. Gallagher, but even hearing you speak about him, it just makes your heart sad for everybody in his life that doesn't get to be there this week for him.
The innovation, I think, in some instances as well, apart from the technological innovations we've had, that tragic death of Conor Connolly, the former Roscommon footballer, and I don't think it was COVID related. I think tragic. It was a tragic death. The man was only in his 40s. But the innovation they had of everybody within their homes displaying on the front window the Roscommon flag locally, and just the whole image of people effectively being confined behind their doors, yet they were able to have this form of solidarity along the route and elsewhere. I mean, I think it really, it was really poignant, the whole thing.
There was another piece of video footage that I think went viral a couple of days ago, Mick. It was from your part of the world. I think it might have been down in Ballyvourney, where there was somebody who had died. I don't think, again, it was from COVID-19, but with the ban on mass gatherings that was in place at the time, what they had done was, in lieu of everyone being able to go to the chapel or to the graveyard for her final interment, what they did was stand at the side of the road 2 metres apart, but they effectively gave her a guard of honour the whole way from the chapel to the graveyard, with everyone spaced out appropriately, which I think was a wonderful gesture given the circumstances. That piece by Alan O'Keefe is on page 10 of the Sunday Independent. There's also some magnificent photographs by David Connacky. A couple of texts and tweets.
I said Alan English, Gavin. Sorry about that.
No, well, in fairness to Alan English, it's his first time editing the Sunday Independent, and I can't imagine the difficulty of trying to edit the country's most read newspaper when you are physically constrained from going into their offices. So fair play to him. I've been able to pull it all together this week. Paul Smith on Twitter has questioned, are we really concerned around the lack of hard data on testing? They're working their asses off. It's the media who aren't happy. Are you not tough? Get out of your little bubble and get over yourselves. Paul, two things to say to that. Firstly, I think you'll find, and maybe I'm speaking from personal experience here, but the media are working their asses off too at the present time. And B, I do think that there is a broader public concern around the lack of hard data on testing, because if we can't really know how many cases of COVID-19 there are out there in the country if we haven't tested everyone who might have it, or at least given them all their results. Fergus, let me keep you for 1 minute just to talk about another issue. I introduced you as a former chief executive of Barnardo's. You are, of course, at the moment on the board of the HSE.
Yeah.
I don't want to get you to talk about some of the internal delicacies that you're not allowed to, but how has governance in the HSE worked at a time like this when it's finding itself having to deal with so many crises? I mean, surely everything can't be referred to the board in the way you might like it to be.
Oh, no, no. And the board has met and discussed that. And we have given the CEO, who is really, really trusted by the board, and that relationship is a very strong one, and so are the senior management team. That there's a very strong relationship has been built up of trust. And we've given him a decent mandate to do what he needs to do. In return, he has agreed to come back to us and volunteered to come back to us on a very regular basis. I think we meet virtually at least twice a week. Some of them are very long meetings, and we get very heavily briefed. I missed some of the earlier discussion about testing, but I know testing is a problem, and it's a problem all over the world, and it is. But I think there's also a bit of a misunderstanding about it. We will never know how many cases of coronavirus there are in Ireland, and we couldn't unless we tested 100% of the population. We know the number of people who have tested positive, and that's important. And we are in a position to conduct pretty vigorous and robust contact tracing because of the testing that's being done, and that's important.
Given your role in the HSE and the responsibility you have to the public, but also to the many frontline staff that work in the agency, what is your position or your concerns around the PPE and the audit we see this morning reported by Susan Mitchell about the quality of it?
Well, I haven't seen that audit, so I'm indebted to Susan. We've all had discussions about it, and my understanding is that there are some problems. I don't know the extent of them. We'll know the extent of them more. But I think Colm, who's probably going to come on with you, Colm has been very frank with us, and I have no doubt he'd be very frank with you. Of course, there are some problems, but I don't think it's quite as bad as being painted. By some, I do want to say, I don't know of time that I've had so much respect for the Irish media as I've had in this one. I think the challenge, the rigor, the scrutiny is all absolutely vital and critical to public confidence. But I hope it's matched. I hope it is being matched by the honesty with which senior management in the HSE have addressed the situation. When there is a problem, they tend to call it out. When they're working hard to try and find solutions, they tend to tell you that. But we're in a worldwide situation where everybody is finding it really difficult. The Americans, and to a slightly lesser extent the British, are outbidding everybody in every conceivable market for every conceivable piece of equipment. They're throwing money at the problem like there was no tomorrow. And that makes it really, really difficult to keep abreast. And in the circumstances that we are, I actually think the HSE has done an extraordinary job. And I'm not saying that as a board member. I think if I was just not a board member but a citizen, I would say the same thing. I think they've done an extraordinary job in keeping abreast. If you look at the international figures, we are in the top 4 or 5 when it comes to keeping the curve at bay. And that's not to say that we won't have a major problem tomorrow. But we're, since this started, we've been a week away from having our hospitals overrun. But we're they're still not overrun. We're still managing to keep ahead of the curve. And that involves an awful lot of people at an awful lot of levels within the HSE running very, very fast to try and, you know, just keep ahead of the game. And they need to have journalists nipping at their heels and running hard after them to make sure that, you know, the scrutiny is there. But they also need to be, I think, respected for the job they've done. There's never been a time in, I think when I was appointed to the board of the HSE, whatever time it was, it feels like 10 years ago, but I think it was less than a year. I think I did a quick tot of the number of articles I'd written in the Irish Examiner that were deeply hostile and critical about the HSE, and it certainly came to a substantial number. But I have to say, I've learned an awful lot in a very short space of time. So, I think, has the senior management of the HSE.
Well, I think the senior management and everyone else in the HSE, they're dealing with the sort of pandemic that nobody in living history has ever been able to or had to deal with before. And I think everyone is learning on the job.
But we're learning on the job.
We will continue to nip at their heels, as, of course, it is our duty to do. We want to talk, by the way, about the fact that all of this is being governed by a caretaker administration. It's 8 weeks since the election, still no sign of a government. Mick, first of all, before any pieces in the papers, although if there's any pieces that catch your eye in the papers about government formation, do raise them. But your assessment of where we are and the oddity that we're dealing with the you know, such a financial crisis as well as a health crisis, and yet we actually don't have an elected government to preside over it.
Yeah, completely. And I mean, it's, I suppose, made perhaps in retrospect, but in terms of result and just in terms of events, thereby events as they were called, it would look like Leo Varadkar, not for the first time for Fine Gael Taoiseach, made a mistake in his timing of the election. We are where we are. We know what the situation is. Three big parties, two of them won't talk to the third. So those two, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have to form it. It now looks like their quest to have a third party involved is going to hit a brick wall. The Social Democrats have ruled themselves out. The Greens and Labour seem to be in a similar situation, in that in both instances it would certainly appear from all reports their respective leaders are anxious to go into government, and to be fair to both of them, I would suggest anxious to go in on the basis literally of just getting things done rather than any personal ambitions. But they don't. Neither seems to have the backing of their party. Therefore, what it seems we're left with, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the group of regional independents, a government that will be shaky and that would certainly lead to the conclusion that we're far more likely to have an early general election. One other thing about that, Gavin, if we do have an early general election, might I suggest, only half in jest, that it'll be one in which the objective of practically all parties will be not to go into government after the election.
Well, I certainly suspect the fiscal circumstances that every party is going to be looking at, there'll be very few people who'll want to tackle a €21 billion deficit head on. Fergus Finlay, you were once upon a time chef de cabinet for the Labour Party. What do you make about Alan Kelly's insistence now that although he will engage with other parties, that he still doesn't believe that Labour has any business actually forming part of the next government?
I think it's rocket science to say that Labour didn't exactly get a mandate in the last general election to be part of this government. I think, you know, it was not a good election for the Labour Party. And it was very clear after the election that insofar as you could say there were winners and losers, Labour was not among the winners. And I mean, it seems to me that you read every 10 years or so, you read paper stories in the newspapers about, and there are some of them in today's papers, about Labour having some kind of national duty to help everybody out and get Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil over the line.
Is that not the case? Was there not a national duty in 2011 to deal with the hard decisions?
Are these decisions any different now?
There
was a national duty in 2011, there was a national duty in 1992, there was a national duty, and exactly the same journalists, no disrespect, Gavin, exactly the same journalists who wrote that there was a national duty on the Labour Party exclusively to form a government in those situations, immediately that government was formed, started putting the knife into the Labour Party as hard as they possibly could. And every time the Labour Party lives up to its national duty, it gets appallingly badly punished. Now, maybe that's fair, maybe that's the way the world, who knows? But I think anyone in the Labour Party who thought that, you know, if they join a government at this point, and by the way, the Labour Party is never asked to join a government unless the economy is in absolute rag order, which it is right now. If they join a government right now, anyone who thinks that the media, and particularly, may I say, the Sunday Independent, whom we've been praising to the hilt a minute ago, is ever going to forgive them for it, would want their heads examined.
But, well, you know, twice or three or four times bitten, then fifth time shy, and I totally get that point, but is there not equally as much, and I'm not saying it's exclusive to the Labour Party, you could make the same case about the Greens or the Social Democrats or others in the Dáil as well, but is there not a circumstance now where there is a crisis and that any party that simply chooses to decide that they don't want to be in government then ought to be held accountable for that decision?
Well, I think that there's truth in that, Gavin, okay? But because there's truth in that, I think any party that decides that it does not want to talk to and will not form a government with the party that got the most votes in the election and the party that almost, but with the exception of the Cowan Cawley, got the most seats in the election, should also be punished. I mean, there is no doubt. We had an election 8 weeks ago. Out of that election, one formula emerged as a democratic, a legitimate democratic choice, and that formula was Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, or, to a slightly lesser extent, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. And from the moment the election was over, everyone, including a significant portion of the media, and it begins to seem to me a significant portion of Sinn Féin, decided nobody wants to talk to us, and so we're going to take our ball and walk off the pitch. Now, that if anybody's being irresponsible, it is the political parties that will not talk to each other when they have a mandate to govern. And there are three political parties in the state right now who can claim a significant mandate. And we all know who they are, and Sinn Féin is one of them. I'm not a fan of Sinn Féin. Everybody knows that. I don't vote for Sinn Féin. But I think there's a democratic imperative. When the people say, we like the cut of this party's jib, I think there's a democratic imperative to include them in the process. And I think it is shameful, to be nothing but honest, that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have decided arbitrarily to exclude them from the process.
Well, there are others who would say that there were six times that Labour was in power between 1932 and 2011 where Fianna Fáil was the most popular party and Labour didn't talk to them then in most cases. But I do want to move on just before we do completely run out of time.
Excuse me now, Gavin. You can't say that. You just can't say
that. Well, there were five instances after 1932 where Fianna Fáil remained the largest party, where they still had more of a popular vote than anyone else, and Labour.
And how many of those occasions did Fianna Fáil offer to talk to the Labour Party?
Well, how many indications did Labour offer to talk to Fianna Fáil?
None. And it was reciprocated. It was vice versa. The first and only time that Fianna Fáil ever offered to talk to the Labour Party was 1992. We didn't particularly want to talk to them in 1992. And you know what happened when we did.
Yes, yeah, we all remember what happened when we did. Sinead O'Carroll, before we completely run out of time, at one point, which is seems to be doing the rounds in more and more op-ed pieces every day, this idea that when the election was fought, only a couple of months ago, it was on the basis that we'd have 11 billion cumulatively to spend over the next 5 years. And now we're going to be in a situation where we're going to be 22 billion euro in the red. Is there a case to be made that when all of this has passed us, that rather than trying to cobble together a government on the premise that it was elected a couple of months ago, that maybe we should have another go at electing a different Dáil instead?
I don't think we're even going to get to that ideological argument that, you know, the life has so changed utterly that a new election is required. I agree with Mick's analysis there that it will just happen. Whatever is cobbled together, because something has to be cobbled together in the coming days and weeks, will not last. And we will be in a situation come autumn that we do need another election. I was of that opinion before this pandemic had hit our shores. I didn't see a situation where we would get to the end of this year without a second election, and I think I'm on record as saying that by the Monday after the election, as you said, which is only 8 weeks ago. I just don't see us getting to even a situation where people are arguing whether it needs to be done because of our changed situation. I think it will just have to be done.
I'd say those who are responsible for putting together the 2020 episode of Reeling in the Years would be delighted that they're only at the start of the decade, because they'll have 10 minutes to whittle down how to figure out how all of this goes in a 25-minute episode. Guys, we will let you go. Thank you very much for taking part in the panel this morning under slightly unusual circumstances, but delighted to have had all of your companies this morning. Sinead O'Carroll, editor at thejournal.ie, Mick Clifford, special correspondent of the Irish Examiner, and Fergus Finlay, member of the HSE board and former chief executive of Barnardos.